The following time has been purchased by the National Stevenson for President Committee to present Adlai Stevenson, Democratic nominee for candidate for the office of President of the United States, speaking in his own behalf. The next voice you hear will be that of Ramsey Elliott, who will introduce Mr. Stevenson.
We are speaking to you from Memorial Auditorium in Fresno, California, where Adlai Stevenson is about to deliver his first major address of the 1956 presidential campaign before 2,000 delegates to the annual convention of the California Democratic Council. This nationwide broadcast includes in its huge audience hundreds of Stevenson's birthday listening parties, organized to celebrate the birthday of the Democratic Party's foremost presidential candidate and to hear this address. Mr. Stevenson is a native of California. He was born in Los Angeles just 56 years ago tomorrow. When Adlai Stevenson is elected president next November, incidentally, he will be America's first 20th century president, the first to have been born in the 20th century, and also the first to have been born in this fabulously expanding West. And now, Adlai E. Stevenson.
The cordiality of your welcome touches me deeply. And I'm happy that while you have noted my birthday, everyone has had the restraint not to mention my age. I'm happy, too, to share this platform with my friend, Senator Kefauver. Who has served the Democratic Party well and will serve it well for years to come. Do you know that some 50 years ago, my parents didn't take Horace Greeley's advice to go west, young man. Instead of that, they took me from California to Illinois. But perhaps it's just as well that they did take me back to Illinois, because at least the presidential competition is tougher here in California, where I'm told that at least one vice president, one senator, and one governor are all ready to save civilization. As far as I can see, they're mostly ready to save it from one another. And mention of the presidency brings me back here to Fresno and to this meeting, because you Californians are going to have a great deal to do with America's decision in 1956 and in years to come. Perhaps the hardest question a candidate for president faces is, why are you a candidate? Now, it's not merely modesty or the effort to conceal the lack of it that makes it difficult to say why one seeks an office so freighted with mankind's destiny. I doubt if any thoughtful person would dare to say that he is wholly qualified to fill that office. And so I shall simply say that I think the important thing in our system is to continue and to improve the dialogue between the two great parties in order to give our sovereign, the people, educated and understanding choices between men and measures. I have the profound conviction that there are certain things our party and our people must say and must do. It is in the hope that I can help them say and do these things that I gladly give myself to this gigantic battle again, knowing full well its burdens and its brutalities, win or lose. During the primary campaign, I hope we can keep in mind that our great objective should not be just the choice of a leader, but the triumph next November of our common cause, our concepts and our convictions about America and about our time on Earth. For it's not, my friends, just who wins, but what wins that counts the most. You may properly ask, too, of me, how I would conduct myself in this campaign. Well, to that I can only reply that I have been your leader before, and you must be familiar by this time with the merchandise. Now, it's aged a bit, but it hasn't changed. And in spite of all of the stories I hear about the new Stevenson who is shortly to be unveiled, indeed, I'm cheered by the unanimity of disagreement about what this new model will be. And I suggest that maybe there are no surprises and it will be the same old model. And I was... Well, I'm glad you like the old model because it's pretty hard to change things that old. I must frankly add that it is quite possible that I would not be the best candidate for you in this forthcoming campaign. If winning is the first objective of any political race, because I have an allergy for hollow promises. Yet I am told on all sides that promises pay, that they are indispensable to victory, and that keeping them is far less important than making them. Well, I don't agree. And even if extravagant promises won us a lot of votes, even if they won a lot of votes for the Republicans in 1952, I remind you that within 2 years, the people gave Congress back to the Democrats. And this time, they're going to finish the job all of the way. And one reason will be that the huckster's arts of salesmanship, of misbranding, of exaggeration have demeaned our government and its communication with the people as never before. Truth has been trespassed too much of late by those who should serve her best, the people's servants. And I say to you frankly that I don't intend to take positions in this campaign which would reduce my effectiveness as president, regardless of the cost in votes. For this campaign, my friends, must deal with the great issues of our time, the issues of war and peace, of our strength and our commitments, of the social revolution of the underdeveloped world and the new communist challenge, of disarmament, of individual freedom and equal opportunity for all Americans, of monopoly, of single interest government, of saving our natural resources from the greedy and so on. We can meet these problems and all of the myriad demands on the home front only as we are honest, as we are forthright, and as we are responsible. To exploit them for cheap political ends is to cheat the people of their democratic birthright, their right to honest understanding of their own problems. And you don't pay your respects, you don't do honor to the greatest office on earth by bidding for it competitively. Let us leave those deceptive techniques to those who value the people's credulity less than we Democrats, because we Democrats are the people. So I am sorry if I cannot sometimes go as far as one or another of my friends would like on one or another of the issues that will confront us. But I say that restraint and responsibility of tone and in emphasis do not mean dilution, and they do not mean half measures. Rather, they mean, as St. Paul said to the Corinthians, "And every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things." I think almost the best example of intemperance in public life that we have lately witnessed is the Secretary of State's recent magazine advertising of his peculiar talent for rattling the saber and brandishing the bomb. Thereby scaring the daylights out of friends and neutrals, the world around, if not out of our enemies. Now, if the Eisenhower administration has to brag some more about something, I wish it could boast instead about resolute marches to the brink of peace instead of to the brink of war. We've heard a constant drumbeat from the Republican politicians and their press that we are prosperous and at peace, and that all is well. This sedative propaganda reached the apex of foolishness after the summit meeting a few months ago. But it is hard to find any area of the world where our situation has not, in fact, deteriorated in late years. While we have reduced our strength, we have enlarged our commitments. While we brag about massive retaliation and atomic intimidation, Russia talks of peace, of trade, of friendship, of economic development, and the things that the sensitive, suspicious, and hungry Asians want to hear. In this age, everyone knows that we have the awesome power of atomic intimidation, and that there are extremities, God forbid, in which we might be compelled to use it. But what is demanded of the powerful is restraint and responsibility. The most effective deterrent is the unity and the strength of ourselves and of our friends. And this is far more than a question of power politics. It is a question of moral responsibility and accountability. I emphatically agree that politics should stop at the water's edge. But surely, that should not prevent us from trying to pull Mr. Dulles back to dry ground. And another thing. The sudden Soviet pressure for a treaty of friendship, implying that any agreement on Germany depends on the United States accepting this treaty, calls for most careful consideration. We must not appear to the free peoples of the world either to reject offers of friendship or to submit to blackmail. Such a treaty offers dangers, then, a false sense of security among us and our friends without any concrete guarantee of German unity. I wish the Secretary of State well in his perplexing difficulties, for the fact is, of course, that the problems of the world today surpass any mortal's power or wisdom and can be dealt with only by a concert of our moral and mental resources, sustained by an electorate that is fully informed and not anesthetized with slogans, sedatives, and sales talk. Now, as for the claim that there are no issues here at home, we are reminded that for 20 years, the Republican Party fought, except in election years, the whole of what they derisively still call the New Deal. Social security, public housing, minimum wages, farm income supports, a flexible fiscal policy, resource development, federal aid to education, medical care, and so forth. That our Republican friends are now accepting all of these things, of course, makes us grateful. After all, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. And And I, for one, am curious to see what is to become of that old Republican reliable creeping socialism, now that the Republicans have adopted it. But the basic issue is who means what he says about these domestic issues and who doesn't. Who is going to do anything about putting these agreed principles into effect and who isn't? On the farm problem, which are we to take seriously? An election year Republican promise or 3 years of Republican performance, during which all of their 1952 campaign promises were broken and the farmer's share of the national income dropped by $4 billion? And what about schools? Which are we to take seriously? An election year Republican proposal that we build half of the new schools that we need, or 3 years of Republican performance consisting of one conference? Behind today's glowing phrases about conservation and development of our resources are 3 years of performance marked by the nullification of policies that have prevailed for almost half of a century. And it is interesting to note that here in California, which has suffered so cruelly this winter, there were no floods in the area where the federally sponsored Central Valley Project had built its dams, as you here in Fresno have reason to know so well. The Republicans have talked piously of the housing shortage, while they junked or slashed the programs intended to halt the urban blight that threatens our cities. They have played politics with the individual rights of Americans in the name of internal security. And yet there is nothing more sacred than a man's reputation, and nothing more solemn than the government's duty to protect it. In short, we are confronted with a variety of national problems, all of them important, many of them urgent. And President Eisenhower has blandly and proudly now presented a new legislative program, largely designed to reverse the policies he so proudly proclaimed 3 years ago when the Republicans came into power. It looks as though our Republican friends had not so much pursued Democratic policies as been pursued by them. And in these days, the typical Republican document proclaims that America has no problems and then goes on to propose Democratic solutions for them. Now, why is this? Well, 1956 is an election year. And from intimate personal experience with these matters, and from my reading of Republican history, I am reminded again of what Disraeli said about the government of his opposition, Robert Peel. He said, "The Right Honorable Gentleman uses two languages, one during his hour of courtship, another for his years of possession." Well, I suggest that the explanation is that this is courtship year. These matters, as I say, are important. They deserve discussion and they deserve action. But I suggest that they are also symptoms of infinitely larger issues. The problem of growth, which next to the Cold War is the most significant fact of modern society, its remarkable expansion, and the resulting growing pains. There are two ways, it seems to me, of looking at America, at its future, and at the role of government in meeting, yes, and in shaping that future. One is to look at today with frequent side glances at yesterday, to think in terms of hanging on to what we have and of staying where we are. And if we complain that something seems to be missing from our daily lives, if we are anxious, fearful, insecure, if our cities are overcrowded, the juvenile courts overburdened, the old people frustrated, the psychiatrists overworked, if millions of us have not enjoyed the vaunted prosperity we hear so much about, if we mention these things A Republican chorus tells us, never mind, after all, you never had it so good. But I would speak here and briefly for a different view of America. We live in a time of danger and a time of great hope. Whoever offers us complacency blinds us to the one and denies us the other. I suggest that there never has been a time when Americans were wholly satisfied. Growth is the very order of our existence in America. We could survive, I think, almost anything except stagnation. Government has an inescapable role in this process. It can stimulate progress or it can retard it. The historic Republican concern, which has its very real point and is and its equally important danger, is that government not interfere, as they say, in people's lives. And so, even in its present election year enlightenment, the administration moves grudgingly, offering at best half answers to hard problems. It reluctantly recognizes people's immediate needs, but not our hopes or our plans, neither our concerns about the future nor our dreams, our physical necessities, but none of our yearning for spiritual growth. Yet the fact remains, and has remained from the time of the Book of Proverbs, and long before, that no nation can survive which will not look ahead, which dares not dream. Unless we can conceive a further future for ourselves, a second journey, we shall remain what we have sometimes seemed to be in recent years, a nation concerned not so much with its own destiny, but with fear of the destiny of its adversary. A people which gives up the vision and settles for the thing we have come to call security is a nation sick and in mortal danger. For security as an end and an aim is a sick man's vain delusion. Security in the true sense of that word is never gained as an end in itself. Nations are secure when they are alive, and alive when they are moving toward their proper ends, the ends they dream of. We were secure when we had the West to open, when we had a continent to master, the Golden Gate to win, when we measured every choice against that high endeavor. The problems which keep us tossing on our beds at night are problems not of death, but of life. It is not loss or lack which challenges our genius as a people, but wealth and plenty. Shall we use our strength to stand still? Shall we use it to build walls around ourselves, imitating our enemies in the delusive hope that thus we can overcome them? Or shall we take this God's plenty and set ourselves a second labor on this continent and beyond it in the world? Shall we conceive and build for ourselves a new civilization such as men have never seen, a new wealth of freedom and of life, using the material means we have acquired, the leisure we have won, the amelioration of sickness and suffering, and the lengthening of the span of life that we have been given? Shall we conceive for ourselves a world truly and creatively at peace, in which the Republic shall be secure in the only true security, the security of life and of hope? Shall we imagine a nation of enlarged and richer lives, in which the great fruitful labors shall go forward, a society dedicated to its proper ends, and vigorous with a hope and a purpose no tyranny can destroy? We have the means, have we the vision? And this is the great question we are now called upon to solve. The journey to which we were committed in those early days of the Republic has been completed. The new continent has been explored. The rim of the Pacific, Golden California, is settled. The problem of food has been solved. Industry has provided our necessities. A vast and complex system of commerce has been perfected. Our standard of living has been fixed above any present level of comparison. Our science is successful. Our skills are fabulous. We know the how of more know-how than any society in history. But this is not the end. It was not for these successes only that we set out 3 centuries and more ago from the tidal rivers of Virginia and the Massachusetts rocks. Our triumphs have been spectacular, but each one, as we have achieved it, has left us questions still to answer. Today's challenges are more than yesterday's. Tomorrow's may be harder still. I don't know. But I do know that we cannot fail to solve our problems as they arise so long as we maintain faith in ourselves, not in dictators or symbols or images, but in each other and in something higher, stronger, and wiser than we. We may look to our public men for leadership, but we must not forget that our ultimate reliance resides here with people like you, in meetings like this, of these remarkable Democratic, California Democratic clubs, which give us such renewed hope. Meetings which bring together men and women who have insisted upon their right and recognized their obligation to participate in the processes of a people's party and a people's government. Your commitment in the end is no different from mine, to devote your energies to the furtherance of the ideals you believe to be right. The future demands of us no departure from principle, no restrictive new political doctrine. It simply demands that we continue with good heart to adapt to an age of change, the marvelous, flexible instrument of government which is our heritage, and that we never lose sight of the better tomorrows, that we make our faith a living thing. This, I say, is the way, the only way, we can pursue our highest destiny in an age that may, in Toynbee's phrase, see the tribes of mankind become the family of man.
Stevenson deliver his first major address of the 1956 presidential campaign before the annual convention of the California Democratic Council in Fresno, California. Adlai Stevenson wants to talk to the people, both on television and on radio, as often as possible during this campaign. That will require a great deal of money, and as everyone knows, the Democratic cause attracts few large contributions. What is urgently needed is a very large volume of small contributions, no matter how small. If you would like to help, send your contributions to the National Stevenson for President Committee, Box 1111, Chicago 90, Illinois. Give your name and address so that your contributions can be acknowledged. And then urge every Stevenson supporter you know to do the same. Let me repeat the address. Send your contributions to the National Stevenson for President Committee, Box 1111, 1111, Chicago 90, Illinois. Thank you. This program has come to you from Fresno, California.
The preceding time was purchased by the National Stevenson for President Committee to present Adlai Stevenson, Democratic nominee for candidate for the office of President of the United States, speaking in his own behalf. This program came to you transcribed from Fresno, California. This is Monitor, the NBC Weekend Radio Service.